can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the peach! Not the peach! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington, senior writer for Consequence of Sound and editor-in-chief of The Spool.
And I am Nathan Raven, tragically of Nathan Raven's Happy Place and also this podcast.
And Champion Sculler.
Champion Sculler.
Which, if you don't know what that is, don't worry, we didn't either, and I kind of still don't. But we're going to try our best to school you through that.
The secretly Canadian podcast.
Yes. It's all bare naked ladies and poutine all up in this hizzy.
That's all been done before.
Yes. Oh, boy. I'm sad that I get that. Yes, for those of you who are just joining us for this first one, first of all, I apologize. You could think of better episodes about better movies. Well, better movies. This will still be a really good episode. But
yeah, I like to think so.
Yeah, exactly.
We're violating one of our things that we set out to do when we started this, which was we thought nobody just wants to hear us. We're garbage human beings. We're just a garbage fire of a podcast. We need guests to breathe life and insight and ingenuity into this podcast. We fucking gave up on this one because
you'd have to mail your DVD copy of A Boy in Blue to a
third person. $45 on Boy in Blue.
It's the most money we've had to spend.
I spent half of the fucking Patreon nut for this entire month on this goddamn movie that I'm angry that I saw, even though I saw it specifically for a professional purpose. Like, yeah. I didn't want for somebody to spend $25. I also didn't want them to spend 2 hours watching The Boy in Blue.
Yeah, exactly. Which, again, like, just to reiterate our concept, we're going through the filmographies of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage, two of who we think are some of the most interesting actors for better and worse in, like, their generation. So, yeah, we're pairing a Travolta and Cage movie every episode. And this episode...
That's what we're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah,
right? That sounds cool.
I know, right?
Super I wonder fun. Why that hasn't taken off yet. That's such a fun idea.
We're people are listening to us. More people are listening to us now than they were with Happy Cast.
I'd also like to think that if the Weird Accord now, the column that I wrote for 3 years, it is now a book.
A glorious
you
book,
can not only buy, but you should buy. It will take off several years from now. After we've given up completely, after like, oh, there's just no idea, there's no audience, this has no future, we will discover at the very end that people love this idea, and it's a great idea, and that we were right all along.
Yes, indeed. But one thing that helps us get some ears on us before we do that is to tell people about this podcast, and if you help support us on Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage.
Don't wait 4 or 5 years. The society might not exist anymore after that.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny because as I record this, it's a couple days before I leave for Sundance, and just saw a news story that the first case of coronavirus in Chicago has just arisen.
Well, that's fun.
So I'm very excited to travel to a place where a lot of people are coming and going.
That's where everybody watches Fast and the Furious and wants to have a Corona with Dom Turturro.
Oh yeah. No, okay, we're wiping out the
that?
Population
that like
quarter
fun.
Mile at a time. But anyway, yeah. So what are we talking about this episode?
We are talking about the 19th century Canadian sculling period piece, The Boy in Blue. And we are talking about the 1980 mechanical bull drama / sociological exploration, Urban Cowboy. And I thought, like, oh, these are like a weird pair of movies. There's not going to be like all sorts of uncanny overlap. And I discovered that, holy fuck, that is true this way as well. We went way up north for The Boy in Blue, which is about one of those historical figures only Canadians give a mad-ass fuck about. Watching this entire fucking movie, I felt like I was watching an SCTV skit that had somehow become a real movie and come to life, because a lot of what they made fun of was shit nobody in America knows about, including the sport of sculling. And then the other movie is we're going all the way down south. We're looking for love in all the wrong places with Urban Cowboy, which is also an unlikely sports drama about a made-up sport. In this case, mechanical bull riding, which is very, very sexy, but a very, very dumb sport all the same.
Yes, it was interesting to watch two movies back-to-back about subjects that I couldn't care less about. And I like to think myself as a fairly empathetic, pluralistic person. I watch enough movies, I'm a film and TV critic, that I usually can, you know, disengage from, like, okay, I'll give this a shot, go at things with an open mind. And I'm like, an hour into Urban Cowboy, and I think, well, the cage match will be pretty easy on this one. I do not give a rat's ass about mechanical bull riding. But also, halfway through Boy in Blue, I thought to myself, boy, I wish I was watching someone ride a mechanical bull. So maybe let's start with the sugar before we get to the medicine. Let's talk about Urban Cowboy.
How you doing?
Fine.
Anything I can do for you?
Well, not yet.
You real cowboy?
Well, it depends on what you think a real cowboy is.
You're a real cowboy, ain't you?
Get him, bud!
Good eye.
A very, very interesting movie. I was kind of excited to go back and look at it because I had a column back when I wrote for The Dissolve, back when that existed about 5 years ago, called Forgot Busters. And the idea of Forgot Busters was I would write about movies that had made the top 25 top grossing films the year that they came out, but it kind of faded culturally, you know, that they did not endure the way some movies do, primarily kind of cult movies, genre movies, stuff like that. And I realized with my very first entry that I'm a fucking idiot and I don't know what I'm talking about, and I have no idea what does and does not endure, because I chose what I did not realize was actually the most best beloved movie of all time, which is 1996 Space Jam. And I was like, holy shit, not only do people care about that movie, but they care about it way too much. It was like, yeah, one of my most read piece, and a lot of people between the ages of 20 and 23 got very, very angry at me for having the heresy to suggest that, you know, maybe Michael Jordan did not contribute as much to, you know, the Looney Tunes legacy as Tex Avery or Bob Clampett or something like that. And I feel like, and I don't know if Urban Cowboy made the top 25, but I feel like that would kind of qualify. And that's weird because I remember Urban Cowboy. I'm older than you, Clint. I'm an old man. And this was a huge cultural event. I mean, this was kind of like, it's sort of, it would be an exaggeration to say that this did for honky tonks and contemporary country music what Saturday Night Fever did for disco. But it definitely was a huge cultural event. A lot of people looked at these sad alcoholics and ex-cons drinking their pain away and having horrible relationships and thought, holy shit, I want to be a part of that. I want to get in on the action. I want to be this sad person breaking their leg, riding a mechanical bull. So it was produced by Robert Evans. Mm-hmm. And Irving Azoff, who is a very, very legendary sort of musical mogul. And it's cut very much from the same cloth as Saturday Night Fever.
It's kind of Saturday Night Hoedown.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Up to the point that it's based on a magazine article that's kind of like, well, let's take a sociological look at this fascinating thing that's happening in society, which is that these hillbillies are getting drunk at this giant warehouse called Gilly's Bar. And that's one of the things that's really interesting about this. And you talk about some occasionally clunky storytelling. There's a moment here where John Travolta's character, Bud, who comes from a small town to the big city with a big old beard to make his fortune and maybe find a lady and whatnot. And he's just rattling off factoids about Gilly's Bar, which is at one point, it's kind of like a cross between a honky tonk and a football stadium.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a cross between like a mega church and like, you know, Tootsie's Orchid Lounge. So that's, again, there are really fascinating things about this, where on one hand, you're keeping the spirit of country alive, and you're keeping the cowboy and Indians and robbers aesthetic alive, but you're doing so in like this very materialistic, very capitalist, a very suburban kind of way that it speaks to kind of the way that country changed over time from being this sort of outlaw underdog sort of music to being, you know, kind of the music of the people who, you know, are in power these days. And yeah, this is a very interesting kind of moment. And in it, John Travolta plays Bud, who comes to Gillies, and his very first time there, he falls into a deep state of lust with a woman named Sissy, who is played by Deborah Winger. And I've never seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. What the fuck am I talking about? I have not seen An Officer and a Gentleman. I have not seen Terms of Endearment. Why would I? Those are like quality films that won awards. Like, why the fuck would I waste my time with that? So this was my introduction to Deborah Winger, and holy fucking shit, was I impressed. Like, this is one of the
She's really good in this.
Well, it's one of the scorchingly sexy performances maybe I've ever seen, and just sort of her chemistry with John Travolta are just fucking insane. You know, there was a, Gene Siskel had a line where he said, you know, would watching this cast have lunch together be more interesting than watching the movie that they made? And I feel like kind of the equivalent in stuff like this is, would you pay good money to watch these people fuck? And in the case of John Travolta and Deborah Winger, the answer is, oh God, yes. Holy shit. And I think that's part of the reason why people looked at, objectively, as kind of a depressing scene and thought, holy shit, I want to be a part of that, is they didn't see the sadness, they didn't see the alcoholism, they didn't see the violence, they just saw
all that stuff is sort of glamorized too.
It's glamorized, all the bar fights
and the beer drinking.
Well, it is and it isn't, you know. I mean, that's one of the things really fascinating about it. And I felt like, I don't know if you have this as well, but I felt like this is a fascinating and transitional film, where I feel like in many ways this is a 1970s movie. You know, it's about kind of grubby outsiders, it's about a sociological milieu, it's about telling these stories that aren't being told, and these communities that aren't being told. But I feel like it's also a 1980s movie, because Robert Evans produced it, because John Travolta really needed a hit after Moment by Moment. So there's this interesting sort of tension and friction between this being kind of this really interesting character study, kind of realistic and gritty, and then also having these kind of crowd-pleasing elements, like the mechanical bull stuff. Yeah. Then again, I'm kind of like, I like it as background. You know, I like it as part of this world. When you devote 45 minutes to it and your movie is a half hour too long, that becomes very, very problematic.
Yeah, when Urban Cowboy tries to be a sports movie, that is when it starts to stumble a little bit, when it falls off the mechanical bull, so to speak. Let's talk about Bud, though, because I think Bud is a really interesting figure to compare to Tony Manero, because there's a lot of similarities. Like, the subcultures are different, but he is a very sort of self-destructive guy who's still very, like, tied to his family, but he wants to find the ineffable sense of freedom and liberation, and he sort of finds that with a mechanical bull, but he also otherwise has very working class background, and also gets tied into this subculture. And he's also a very self-destructive guy, right? I mean, he's absolutely a jerk. He's especially a jerk to Sissy. He hits her, he cheats on her, all this kind of stuff. But
not only does he cheat on her, but he cheats on her in particularly insulting, confrontational ways. I mean, that's part of what makes it so interesting, is you're kind of like, these people should break up because they're really shitty for each other.
Yeah.
And they have a really toxic bond. But at the same time, there is this, again, this kind of love-hate dynamic where they can't give each other up, but they can't be a part of each other's world without creating all of this friction and all of this tension. And yeah, the storytelling is really, really interesting here, where, yeah, there's a scene where they're at a diner.
Yeah.
And she kind of pinches him and he smacks her, and he smacks her fairly hard. And you don't know if it's kind of a reflexive thing or if it's like, this man has experience hitting women. And they run out into the thing and it becomes this whole big thing where he's chasing after her in his truck. And then he basically tackles her, and they're like rolling around in the mud, and you're like, and then literally the next scene they're married.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. Like, I was saying, like, is that sending toxic, weird, like, you know, like that episode of, it was a bit, soap opera where, yeah, they had that couple get married after one of them was raped, where it's like, are you sending the message that, like, again, and, like, yeah, I don't know. So what did you think of about that particularly jarring, so sort of jump both in time and in storytelling from these people being, you know, squabbling and getting dirty together to, oh my God, now they're husband and wife.
Oh, I thought it was particularly jarring, but I think occasionally in ways that served the story. I'm torn as to whether or not, as to how toxic they thought it all was. I mean, obviously, I think them getting married so quickly is the beginning of their troubles. Mm-hmm. As, you know, he starts to get settled and resentful, because Bud is a very fragile person.
Yeah,
he's a very emotionally fragile. Like,
he's kind of, I mean, it's a bit of a toxic masculinity, and also his masculinity is very, very fragile to the point where he can't stand even Sissy riding on the mechanical bull. Not only that, but I mean, like, there's a scene where Deborah Winger, and he's like, oh, I'm using my bad John Travolta Brooklyn accent when I should be using his actually pretty good Texas accent. I think that's another thing too, is I feel like his performances can be of greatly varying quality. Also, his southern accents can be a very southern, and I feel like he has a pretty subtle one. He's just basically doing the Travolta voice with a bit of a twang and a bit of a twang,
draw. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not as overbearing and distractingly hammy as it would be in, say, The Boys in Rose. He has a very, very, you know, and that's, I think, you know, what makes Deborah Winger's performance so fascinating is that she's such a spirited, independent, feisty woman. She has such a strong personality. She has so much going on, but she inhabits this world where there are very rigid gender roles. And the idea is that if you're a wife, you clean up the trailer and you bring your husband a beer first thing in the morning. That's the thing, you know, that they don't.
Like, he openly complains that she doesn't do those things.
And she doesn't clean, and then she should be available for sex at all times.
Yeah.
And again, I think that this is another instance where, because John Travolta is so appealing as a personality, as an actor, that we think of his character as being a lot less problematic and a lot less terrible than they are. Like, when I was thinking back on this, I'm like, oh, he's like a rough around the edges guy. He's a little scrappy. It's like, no, he hits women. You know, he says horrible things, but when he wants to make Sissy jealous, he fucking brings a woman home. In a way, that's literally like, I'm going to fuck this woman, and I'm going to fuck her solely to make you angry.
Objectionable shit. But that's also like, that feels part of the sociology of it too, right?
And it's interesting too, just kind of the way that they deal with class, where this woman that he picks up to make Sissy angry, she's rich, you know, she has money and she has class. And for her, this is kind of, you know, she's slumming. You know, there's this idea of you want a cowboy. And that has a positive and a negative connotation to it.
Yeah, there's a valorization of that kind of rugged masculinity.
Well, and there's all this idea of, like, you want a cowboy who might smack you around a little bit every once in a while. And that's incredibly disturbing. And I think in 1980, it was obviously, like, it's not cool that this shit happens. Like, it's really disturbing. But I think there was also a sense of, this is part of this world, you know, and it's a component. And yeah, I guess there are a lot of really interesting choices. Like, there's a scene where John Travolta, another kind of analogy between this and Saturday Night Fever, is that not only is it very specifically about a working class guy, there are a lot of scenes of him actually at work. And that's, and you don't see that in a lot of movies, you know, but again, I think it kind of speaks to the sociological element to it, to the realism. And yeah, there's a scene of him nearly dying in a pipeline. And then it's kind of cut with Sissy having a fun time at Gilly's and getting really, really turned on by an absolutely disgusting human being played by Scott Glenn.
Yeah.
And Scott Glenn is amazing. The first time that we see him, like, a really, really great introduction. As he's
with that mesh shirt.
You talk about being a fucking badass. Like, he is on a prison rodeo. You know, so it's not enough that he's a fucking rodeo rider, that he's, like, willing to, like, you know, risk getting his back broken for the sake of, like, being on that fucking bull for 8 seconds. He's a fucking ex-con, you know? And the first time you see him, he's wearing a see-through mesh shirt, you know, the kind of fishnet, and the kind of thing that a stripper might wear.
Yeah.
But because he's so rugged and so tough and masculine, like, he's fucking terrifying.
Right. Because when he first goes in, like, all the other dudes in the bar are, like, cracking wise about the mesh shirt, but he impresses them so much on the mechanical bull that he shuts them right up.
Oh, yeah. And he becomes kind of the master of the mechanical bull, and they put him in charge of running the mechanical bull. And yeah, she is just super, super, super turned on by him. And again, it's a thing where I feel like the movie doesn't necessarily judge her for that. You know, there isn't this idea that, you know, that for a woman to have sexual hunger is bad. Even if, yeah, obviously, her relationship with this disgusting human being goes predictably south. And it comes out, because again, I feel like he's kind of the demonic side of Bud. Like, oh, yeah, they're very similar men in a lot of ways. And I feel like, yeah, Bud goes too far, but has some sort of sense of shame and guilt and morality. And I feel like Sarkhan's character is a sociopath.
And oh, absolutely. He will kill people, he will rob banks to overcome.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And yeah, that does make Bud seem more sympathetic by comparison, even though, yeah, for much of the film, he is a repellent human being. One thing that I thought was kind of interesting about this is very early in the film, we get to see John Travolta two-step.
Oh, yeah.
And I fucking loved it. And I wish that there was like 20 minutes of John Travolta dancing in this movie, because it's so much fun. He has so much joy. And there's just a sense of just, you know, release. And I feel like it's not quite the same on the mechanical bull. And it's just not that interesting of a sport.
Like, I wish it was more of a two-step movie than a mechanical bull movie.
Oh, this was definitely
choreographed
by
Patsy Swayze, right? Because
that was his
first big thing as a choreographer.
Yeah. And then at a certain point, Bud decides that he's going to like win Sissy back by winning the big mechanical bull competition at Gilly's. And I feel like it's kind of like the disco contest at the end of Saturday Night Fever, except that in Saturday Night Fever, they established this shit doesn't matter.
And also, there aren't even any people of color to be racist towards.
No, there aren't. Is there a single black person in this entire motion picture?
Yeah, exactly. So in addition to that, I mean, you know, watching this movie brought up a lot of memories for me, even though this is the first time I'd actually seen Urban Cowboy.
Sometimes
I get it confused with Midnight Cowboy.
They're very different movies.
They're very different movies.
That share a similar
time.
Title.
And they had, because I was like, oh, they're cowboys in the city, but no. Because Urban Cowboy, I suppose, here is just, it's more a reference to the kind of country western culture that this movie ended up sort of presaging, or at least like heralding, this sort of new
I feel like it was kind of in my mind talk about mixed up, I halfway misremember this as Rhinestone Cowboy and I think that's partially because that's kind of the same sentiment, you know. So you have cowboys, and that's kind of in quotation marks, and you become cowboys by wearing combat boots. You wear cowboy boots.
Jesus.
You wear a cowboy hat, you wear, you know, tight jeans, and you drink too much, and you listen to, you know, Charlie Daniels and Bonnie Raitt, both of them are in this movie. That's another thing that I loved, the live music.
Oh, the music was great. The soundtrack was another banger, too.
I mean, this is a movie that, you know, looking for love in all the right places, like this movie that probably one of the biggest songs of 1980. And again, it's one of those moments where, like, yeah, this is the perfect song for the movie. And the whole soundtrack captures this very interesting kind of moment in country where, you know, the Garth Brooks explosion hadn't happened, you know, hadn't gotten super duper extra slick and mainstream and popular, you know, but like the outlaw country had faded. And yeah, it was a very interesting. And I mean, I love country music. And I feel like there's just, oh, hold on there. A giant box of books here. Hold on. But yeah, so I have a lot of nostalgia for this period in country music, and also this period in American film as well. And there aren't that many like serious films of quality about country music, and I respect it for all of its flaws and its overreaching and being way too long and making too much of the mechanical bull. I appreciated this was like a genuine, sincere, realistic look at a world that we haven't really seen a whole lot in the ensuing 40 years, despite the incredible popularity of country music.
Right. Yeah. I mean, despite having not seen it, it reminded me a lot of the culture that I sort of grew up in. Because, I mean, I'm not from Texas, but I am from downstate Illinois. And that place is very much steeped in, like, the kind of urban cowboy aesthetic and the sound. And a lot of people around me wear the tight jeans with the cowboy shirts and the cowboy hats and the cowboy boots and all of that. Like, a lot of people of my mom's generation, even a lot of people in my generation, just do that. And so I feel very somewhat keyed in to, even though I was a latchkey kid down in downstate Illinois, I felt like I knew these kinds of people growing up. And it felt like, for what it's worth, it did sort of capture that, that sort of devil may care, that almost kind of nihilistic working class Rust Belt kind of stuff, where you,
well, I think there's definitely,
you go there to the bar to get drunk and like,
oh, well, definitely,
have,
I
affairs
think,
with each other and ride the, well, mechanical bull.
Well, I think with this and Saturday Night Fever, there's a sense of being poor, and America, mm-hmm, is fucking brutal and joyless, and it kills your fucking soul, and you need to do something to feel alive.
Yeah. Even especially if you're a man, and you need to feel like a man.
Oh yeah, you know, and even if it kills you inside, even if it's self-destructive, like, you need to live, and this is a place where you can live, and you can be your best and your worst self. Yeah, and there are elements of fantasy. One of his first nights in the big city, he totally has sex with a pair of sisters. Did you see who these sisters were?
No, I didn't.
Jerry Hall and her sister, the legendary former wife of Mick Jagger. Now she's married to fucking Rupert Murdoch. You might know her as Jack Napier's girlfriend in Batman. Okay. But yeah, so there's very much this idea that, like, a very hypersexual realm. That's very interesting. I mean, I love the look of this movie. It's very kind of gritty and sexy and realistic. The man who directed it, James Bridges, the year before he did China Syndrome, which was an enormous, enormous hit. And he kind of specialized in movies that were realistic, you know, that kind of told stories that mattered about real people, about real things that were going on. He also directed Perfect, so no one is perfect. But I feel like, you know, the supporting cast is really strong here. Barry Corbin is always good in everything that he does. Again, Scott Glenn.
Yeah, Scott Glenn is great.
Really, like, charismatic.
He
and again,
has that,
like,
steely,
he's
sort of mystery.
He's fucking sexy as hell. You know, and that's like, he shouldn't be. He's a disgusting motherfucker. But there's just something about it. It's his confidence, and just, he knows exactly who he is. And even though that's a disgusting, repellent human being, like, there, again, there's a magnetism. You can understand how Sissy would be attracted to him, even though he's a horrible person,
that
even though he's married to an incredibly sexy, very attractive guy, who, again, has a lot of flaws and a lot of weaknesses. And that, again, there's just kind of this electricity between them at all points, and sometimes it's they're fucking and it's amazing, and sometimes it's like they hate each other more than anybody else in the entire world. And that magnetism and that sexual chemistry between Deborah Winger and John Travolta, I think, is what makes this movie. Like,
without that,
you have, you know, an actress that doesn't have chemistry with him. You have a less, you know, spirit. You have a less talented, a less ferocious force. You know, this could be, you know,
I mean, she's no Cynthia Dale in The Boy in Blue, but we'll get into that later.
Or Staying Alive. My God, you know, it's fucking female lead in that. They could not have less chemistry.
Right.
But yeah, they're just, it's, they fucking make this movie work.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the look of the movie, which I agree is really, really interesting. He was shot by Ronaldo Villalobos, who is known for a lot of movies in the 80s having, like, really dark, realistic cinematography. He did 9 to 5. He did Risky Business, 9 to 5. Oh God, what else? Major League.
Risky Business, another very
American
sexy movie.
Me, A Bronx Tale. Yeah, like,
yeah,
all kinds of really great stuff. It's a really good looking movie. I mean, I think it functions in conversation with Saturday Night Fever. I would be really interested to see, like, some scholarship on that, actually, like, just real deep dives into how these movies, like, treat masculinity and subculture.
Yeah, and I think it was on Facebook recently, somebody asked, like, hey, is John Travolta actually a talented actor, or is he just, like, a good-looking guy with an interesting personality? And I think this is one of those movies where he really acts, and he becomes a character. And he plays somebody who is very unlikable in a lot of different ways, yet you can't give up on him. You know, there's, like, this spark that keeps you rooting for him, even though he keeps doing ugly, you know, brutal things that, you know, are objectively very, very, very
Well, I think what people confuse that with, I think there's a knowing lack of self-awareness with Travolta's characters.
Yeah.
Where they don't recognize how poisonous they're being. And I think Travolta is able to smartly play that.
Yeah, very much so. There's no sense of self-consciousness here. Uh-huh. The sense is just that he acts and he behaves in the moment. And also,
but to the cynical, it reads as naivete.
Well, and also there's something kind of childlike about him.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and I kind of read about, you know, this is sort of fits into his sweet spot, playing sexy morons and sexy assholes. and he's both there, where he's kind of a dumb dude. You know, he's just kind of like, he's good at what he's good at. And he's pretty childlike and immature and all over the place otherwise.
And I think he knows about his deficiencies a little bit, which is why he lashes out on some level.
Well, and I think he also probably realizes that, like, Sissy is better than he deserves, you know, and that she's smarter and that she deserves a dude who doesn't treat her like crap and who doesn't, you know, expect her to, like, play the role of little wifey. There's this tension and this push and pull that I find really, really fascinating, where she is trapped in this world of gender roles and you know, doing exactly what your mother did, yet she's rebelling against them all the same, you know, in a way that she maybe doesn't even understand herself.
Right, exactly. Do we have any other thoughts on Urban Cowboy? I think it's just a fairly solid movie that I think has been kind of forgotten in the culture.
Despite launching
an entire subculture.
Oh, very much so. And I feel like, well, it didn't launch it, but I think it's it popularized.
It popularized it. But, you know, in much the same way that, like, Saturday Night Fever did.
Oh,
like,
yeah, definitely so. And again, I feel like if this movie were a half hour shorter, it would be a lot easier.
The whole movie's a whole last 2 hours 15, so yes. it's a slog.
But there are a lot of really wonderful moments in it,
and yet feels half as long as the 90-minute movie we watched after that.
Dear God!
Yeah, The Boy in Blue.
Ned Hanlon is determined to become the fastest man on water.
You don't know how good you are, do you?
Sure, I do.
But first, he's got to reform himself. Refine himself.
This is making me sick, wearing these monkey suits.
Control himself. And prove himself.
Get up! Harvard man!
There's a world of bloody difference between rowing to escape the police and rowing like a champion in competition.
They couldn't break his records.
You'll never win another bloody race.
Or his pride.
Mr. Hanlon, you wouldn't recognize wit and sophistication if it hit you in the face.
Fine.
Because he's trained too long.
Still haven't seen what he can do when he really puts his mind to it.
Pushed too hard.
I want to win fair and square, not at all.
And risked too much.
We bet $20,000.
He's an investment that's going sour.
To settle for anything less than being the best there is.
You're going to beat him.
I know I can.
Nicolas Cage is The Boy in Blue. The true story of a legend who left history in his wake.
You just experienced the magic and the wonder of The Boy in Blue. Why don't you tell me what this wonderful motion picture is about?
Yeah, I still got the migraine from it. Okay, so The Boy in Blue, 1986, a Canadian sports biographical drama directed by some guy named Charles Girott and starring Nicolas Cage as the oh-so-Canadian sculler, which is just kind of this, like, competitive rowing that was popular in Canada like a century ago.
Well, no, we saw the introductory opening credits.
Oh,
there,
yeah.
And they're like, before
they
basketball.
They know they're in trouble that they have to explain to us, no, really, people like sculling. Trust us on this.
It said, before basketball, before baseball, before football, rich and poor, high and low, they loved one thing, sculling. Fortunes were made and lost. Oh, dear. And again, I felt like I was watching like a PBS Masterpiece Theater thing gone horribly awry.
Well, the music makes you feel like that. It's very corny kind of triumphant scores.
I think they're also trying to do the Chariots of Fire thing.
Oh, totally.
You know, of like, oh, this is like this old-timey crowd-pleasing story, minus the crowd-pleasing aspect, with a funky synthesizer score to be contemporary. It's like, wait, no, you're being bad in two different jarring computer
Yeah, I felt
now.
Like I was watching a Polaroid commercial.
So tell me more about this fascinating Ned Hanlon fellow. Yes. He seems like quite the bad boy of sculling, is he?
I guess in that he's just kind of a classic Nick Cage dumb idiot. Sculler Ned Hanlon, who is a real life guy who is a champion sculler before becoming a politician, I guess.
We don't need to tell you that if you're Canadian, he's one of your gods.
Yes, exactly.
That it's and him and Justin Bare Trudeau Naked Ladies. And
everyone else. For us Yanks on the other side of the border, we have to learn about this Canadian competitive rowing champion who came from obscurity. He was like basically a bootlegger when we see him in the beginning, but he has potential.
He was a very, very bad boy. He's not your dad's sculling champion.
Oh, yeah, this one fucks. But yeah, he gets recruited by this promoter or whatever, this like unscrupulous gambler named Bill, played by David Naughton, who did this and Amityville 7 and American Werewolf in London. And
recorded the disco hit Making It.
Oh, did he?
From the television show about disco. And you probably are a little too young for this. He's also known from the Dr. Pepper commercial. I'm a pepper, you're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Oh, God. See, I always got him confused with Zach Galligan from the Gremlins
movies. Oh, and then also, well, probably because he's the American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, exactly.
He was a star of a totally classic horror movie, then went away forever and did nothing. And went away forever and did nothing includes his performance here, where I feel like he's supposed to be a colorful rapscallion.
Yeah.
But really, he's just wearing a silly hat and has an enormous mustache. And literally every character in this movie just has a ridiculously elaborate mustache and wears like 6 or 7 hats at all times, except for Nicolas Cage, who's like half naked and wearing contemporary garb. Like my wife would come in and she'd be like, why is Nicolas Cage wearing contemporary clothing in this period movie? And I'm like, because he doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't care. And that's the thing that's fascinating to me is that for the movie Birdie, a movie in which Nicolas Cage was very, very invested. He had 2 teeth removed. He slept in bandages for weeks and weeks and weeks. He lost 15 pounds to play a real-life Canadian person who had a mustache his whole goddamn life. Nicolas Cage chose to not have anything resembling a Canadian accent. He sounds exactly like a person from Los Angeles in 1986. Not a single goddamn mustache on his face. And I was like, oh, well, he must be the only person in Canada who did not have a mustache. And then I go look up on Wikipedia, every single fucking picture of him, he has a mustache.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, very, very American, it's a very modern performance. Like, I think you wrote in your piece that he looks like a time traveler.
He totally does. And not only that, but like, you know, my wife was like, and he wears like these skimpy little exercise outfits that look like they could come from 1980.
Yeah, he's wearing like the headbands and all that.
What people have exercised in like hasn't changed that much over the course of the last 120 years or so. But I mean, he might as well be rocking a Speedo.
Yeah.
It's that contemporary. He might as well like have a Walkman on him at various times. And it's like, why would you take this role, which I imagine is really challenging. I'm not guessing that it, you know, pays a gazillion dollars or anything. You know, it's not going to do wonderful things for your career. Like, what could possibly have convinced Nicolas Cage to act in this movie that he obviously could not be less emotionally invested in?
I'm not sure. Maybe he finally wanted to just be the lead for once. Because he spent the last few movies we've seen of him, he's been like, they've basically been buddy movies where he is like, you know, and it's sort of the case here with like David Naughton, but like, there's not really much there. He's still very much a supporting character, but like in the poster for The Boy in Blue, like if you just look at the poster for The Boy in Blue, you would have no idea that it's a period piece because it's just him like holding dumbbells.
Well, and I used to watch that and I'm like, oh, that's contemporary rowing drama. Like that looks very boring. I don't want to see the fucking contemporary rowing drama.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I had no idea that it took place in the 19th century.
Yeah. And the opening Canada. 30 seconds, you see like a penny farthing bicycle. I'm like, wait a minute.
Yeah, and Christopher Plummer is in this as well. Can you explain to me what the fuck Christopher Plummer is doing in this motion picture?
He's essentially the villain. He's this wealthy businessman who wants to take control of Hanlon's career and sort of, you know, he uses him for his own financial gain and drops him when he doesn't need him anymore. But basically, he keeps wanting to have him, like, fix races. And but Nick Cage is all like, no, man, I want to play to win. I want to win fair and square.
I'm too extreme.
What's that all about, eh?
I'm going to drink some Mountain Dew and win this race.
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage forever. It's like, let don't say your name. Let me
bulk up on protein, man. And so like the whole movie is pretty much just him acting like a jackass and training for sculling races and exchanging really awkward dialogue with both his friend and Christopher Plummer and Cynthia Dale, who plays like Knox's niece, with whom he falls in love with but has zero chemistry with.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about this is I feel like literally the only thing that I got from this movie was that it was fun to look at Nicolas Cage with his shirt off.
And they give you plenty of opportunities to do so.
He totally, I mean, it's like a Matthew McConaughey performance here, mm-hmm. where the only purpose is for him to take his shirt off.
I've always been, like, jarred, too, by, like, historical movies that have people with, like, ripped fucking abs. Because, like, that wasn't what cut people looked like. That wasn't what was considered healthy and handsome, you know? I mean,
if you think about, like, the greatest athlete of the 1920s was Babe Ruth. You know?
Right, right.
And he was an enormous bear of a man. And I looked, like, and Ned Hanlon was a very ripped, very, very fit individual. And again, he's just such a cipher, such a boring figure. Then there you go, like, not only did he win every match, but then he became a successful politician and won, like, every election. Like, so, like, maybe that was his whole political point, was just, like, screw the man. I kind of felt like this was sort of a Nicolas Cage's version of an early Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah, a little bit.
You know, where you kind of have this sort of overly cocky young man who thinks he's the best because he is the best. And then he has, like, an older mentor, and then he learns life lessons, and he, like, gets the girl at the end. But yeah, so I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, because he needed, you know, sort of like the all the right moves, kind of that era of Tom Cruise where he was just pure arrogance and pure brashness. And that fits Tom Cruise so much better than Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And what Nicolas Cage makes him interesting is that he's crazy, not that he's cocky and looks really good.
Yeah, he tries to channel his patented Cage rage into that, but it just sounds petulant.
Yeah.
And especially given the super Canadian dialogue he's asked to give, like, you bloody bugger. Like, he shouts at someone across a boat, and there's all kinds of weird, stupid stuff. There was some, like, monologue that you mentioned in your piece that I thought was really
he's talking to, like, the fancy lady, and he's like, don't go with him, he's totally a wet goose, he still uses Dr. Hammond's hair promoter. He's like, God, if this movie was just about him calling people wet gooses and talking about somebody using hair promoter, like, I would 100% be on board. If this was just I feel like there's a tremendous potential for self-parody, for goofiness, for being so conventional and so cliche that you come all the way on top and become funny and goofy, but that potential is really underrealized, because for the most part this is a very boring movie about bullshit that nobody cares about.
Exactly. Like, it's so tedious. Like we said, you know, Urban Cowboys, 2 hours 15, and this is only 90 minutes, basically. It's like less than 100 minutes. And this movie felt twice as long.
It did. I felt angry. And again, it's not like the worst fucking movie in the world, but it has no reason to exist. And it has such an incredible gift in a young Nicolas Cage, and it does absolutely
squanders it. That. Yeah, yeah. Well, and also, it's all centered around the most boring sport to watch. Like, oh, God, what are you supposed to do with someone just moving their arms back and forth in a boat?
Well, I guess it's pretty and lyrical, you know, and it kind of, like, has a nice glacial kind of movement. But if you want to get people excited, if you want to create something that's crowd-pleasing, if you want to have energy and excitement, like, there's nothing there. Like, this is even, like, an elegantly or handsomely mounted period piece. It's just a mounted piece. It feels like drunk history at times. It's nothing but mustaches and hats and, like,
three-piece suits,
dandies. And... yeah, I loved a lot of the clothes in here. Like, yeah. the story itself could not be less emotionally engaging.
Exactly, and all of the training stuff and, like, the races themselves go on forever. Like, you know, I finished watching this right before we recorded, and I was like, and Nathan, you'd ask me, like, are we ready to go? And, like, hold on, 20 more minutes. 15 minutes of it is just this race on, by the way, they have to let you know that it's the River Thames, England, location card, which I thought was very fun. That's, like, where he has his final race or whatever.
Yeah, he takes over the whole world of sculling, which rivets people all over the world, from Australia to United States.
Before football, before soccer, before the interesting sports, there was sculling.
And I feel like this is of interest only as kind of the apex and the nadir of this idea of Nicolas Cage as a body. you know, and as an athlete and as this like physically perfect form. And I feel like it's kind of the apex of that, and that he's never looked better. He's never been in better shape than Nadir, and that he's never been less engaging on that level. And if they're like, well, when did Nicolas Cage from being Mr. Sexy to like, you know, Nicolas Cage we all know. And I think a lot of it might be Raising Arizona, because they had him get really skinny for that and lose all of his muscles and play like a Wile E. Coyote type figure. And I don't think they ever really came back, you know? And he's not, he's a cartoon character in that movie. And he was like explosively, you know, like a young Marlon Brando level of sexiness and everything before that. So I'm very excited to see Raising Arizona, because I love that movie. And I'm excited to see where it will fit into Nicolas Cage's career.
Indeed, indeed. And but what a way to send out the Hunkasaurus era of Nicolas Cage and Boy in Blue, which is like the only times that it's ever interesting is when he has his shirt off.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And it reminds me of like, I don't know, like Firebirds, which is another kind of exceedingly unimportant movie in our very near future that, again, is kind of like Nicolas Cage doing the Tom Cruise thing. Only with Tommy Lee Jones and Sean Young, and doing, I'm guessing, an even worse, an even weirder version of that kind of pro-military propaganda than Top Gun, which I'm going to go on a limb and saying that's probably the movie that they wanted to be, / riffed off shamelessly.
Oh, I totally. I cannot wait to see that. So yeah, I mean, it's funny, we're probably talking about this one about half as long as Urban Cowboy, but it's less than half as interesting. So
it is.
You can't even fact check what we're saying about The Boy in Blue, because it's impossible to find.
I'd say unless you're a Canadian.
Yeah, unless you're Canadian, then it's everywhere.
It's on Disney Plus. It's the only thing on Disney Plus.
All like, it's the CN Tower gift shop is just full of DVD copies of The Boy
Degrassi
in Blue.
Junior High, all of the different iterations.
Yes. Degrassi The Next Generation, Degrassi Deep Space Nine. it's all great.
Degrassi in the Hood.
Yes, Degrassi Voyager, yeah. So, that's pretty much it for The Boy in Blue, really.
Yeah, that works for me.
Yeah. Question. So, since we're running kind of short, I was wondering.
Yes.
Have you seen Color Out of Space? Did you watch that screener?
I have not
seen Color Out of
Space. I have not. I'm excited about seeing it.
Yeah.
But I've just been, you know, with the book stuff.
Totally busy and all that. But maybe, like, after I get back from Sundance, we do a little, like, Patreon special.
Yeah, totally for me. I'm very excited about that. And I'm excited, too, that Nicolas Cage is doing interesting things and having a comeback.
Yeah,
that continues. Same cannot be said of Mr. Travolta, unfortunately.
No.
He was banging it all on that Oscar for The Fanatic.
This is a gossamer time for this podcast where Travolta's going to be. I wonder how much longer it'll be when like Travolta movies actually win the cage matches.
Yeah, that's true. And it's interesting as well that like they made very few movies kind of early in their career. You know, they make a movie a year or a movie every other year, and now they make six fucking movies a year.
Right. Yeah, it's going
to
be real.
And the more they make, the less they tend to matter.
Yeah, it's true. Now that we're finished talking about both of those, we should probably just get the business out of the way, the cage match. Which one's better, Nathan, Urban Cowboy or The Boy in Blue?
I've completely forgotten about The Blue. So I'm going to say Urban Cowboy by a landslide.
Yes, same here. Urban Cowboy, especially since like if we were to somehow vote Boy in Blue in, I don't ever want to have to think about talking about Boy in Blue again. So let's just relegate it to the dustbin of history.
Well, and they're definitely like, you know, I'm spent a lot of the last couple of months editing various chapters of my book, The Weird Accordion and Al, and I've, you know, I kind of see the Travolta Cage project being also a book 5 years from now, and I will not have a hard time reducing my article about The Boy in Blue to 300 words, because nobody fucking cares. There's nothing interesting about it other than Nicolas Cage looks fucking hot.
Exactly. Congratulations, Urban Cowboy, for the easiest competition you could have asked for. So yeah, that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Thanks so much for listening.
We'll have better movies and a guest next time.
Yes, indeed. Nathan, what are we doing next time, actually?
Goodness, we've got a awesome, I believe we're either on, the next movie for Mr. Travolta is called Blowout.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
This is the one I've been waiting to talk about.
Yeah, it's going to be fucking awesome. And then I believe Raising Arizona. So yeah, Raising Arizona or Peggy Sue Got Married.
I think it's Peggy Sue Got Married, because it was Blowout and Raising Arizona before we remembered that Birdie was a thing.
Oh, okay.
Or Racing with the Moon, whichever.
But yeah, so the next two, a lot of awesome movies from both dudes.
Yeah, we're really going to hit our stride, I think.
Which I'm really excited about.
And we'll have great guests, and we hope you keep listening, and we hope you keep pledging to the Patreon. It really helps us. Yeah, exactly. And so, like, in terms of plugs and stuff, you know, Nathan, you have a book out. Tell people about the book. I do indeed.
And you helped me with the copy editing and whatnot on it. Right. Yeah, my book is called The Weird Accordion to Al, and I spent 3 years writing it. I wrote about every single album Weird Al Yankovic has recorded so far, every single track on every album. I wrote Weird Al's coffee table book earlier this decade, Weird Al the Book, and I saw this as kind of a follow up, kind of a companion piece. And Weird Al not only helped copy edit, he wrote the introduction, he fact checked, and he said really, really lovely things about the book on Facebook and Twitter, and it's had a really great first week. So yeah, please buy my book, The Weird Accordion to Al, available only on Amazon right now, available in paperback and ebook.
Yes, one thing that really leavened the horror of receiving the DVD copy of The Boy in Blue was also getting my copy of The Weird Accordion to Al with a very nice note by Nathan. So it was
there are several more copies headed your way. Along with the Blu-ray of Mikey and Nikki. I never got around to sending you.
Oh, that's so right. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, it's the least I can do.
Of course. So yeah, once again, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Travolta Cage. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. You can follow us on Twitter at Travolta Cage, and you can send us email at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. As soon as an email comes in, we'll read it. I promise. Oh yeah, and then just, yeah, pledge to the Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. We do bonus episodes and all of that. Thank you so much for listening. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go poo.